Hello, I'm Ed Butler. Welcome to In the Balance, the World Service programme that examines the biggest stories from the world of business and finance and how they affect us all. Today, we're looking at Europe's refugee crisis, a story that's scarcely been away from our headlines over recent weeks. Tens of thousands have been entering or trying to enter the European Union in recent weeks and months, many of them seeking refuge from the conflict in Syria and elsewhere, and many now trying to transit European borders, with EU leaders divided and uncertain as to what to do with them. Of the rich European countries, only Germany and Sweden appear to have been letting them in with any degree of willingness, although even that may be changing with new barriers preventing migrants crossing into Germany from Hungary and elsewhere at the moment. In a few minutes, we're going to be discussing the economics of the debate over this human influx. But first, let's hear from the front line itself. Fergal Keane and Lise Doucette have been reporting this week on the latest crisis for the BBC.
They walked like people who still had belief. Mile after mile, from country to country. They crossed the gap in Hungary's iron fence with one destination in mind. Many oblivious to the doors that were closing across Europe.
Have you heard that the borders have been closed by Germany and now probably Austria?
We didn't hear that, said Mohamed Atawil, age 73. All we're looking for is a safe place to live. Europe's response to this crisis has been muddled and disunited from the start. Now there's a definite hardening of attitudes, with states refusing quotas and talk of deportations. For most, Europe begins here on the shores of Greece after crossing from Turkey. Large numbers of them are Syrians, drawn by the belief they would get a better future in Angela Merkel's Germany. Like Khaled Iqbal and his daughter Wade. He's a war amputee, and we met them at the start of their journey in Turkey. I want to reach Europe, he told me, and get a better life and an education for my children. His daughter wants to study in a German university. 2 weeks after I met them, Khaled has reached Germany and is claiming asylum.
Thank God, I am happy in Germany. They are friendly people. They have been kind to us.
Listen to them chanting right up against the metal fence that slammed shut on the Serbian-Hungarian border. Huge crowd. Young men, women and children are now right up against this fence. Some of the men even are grasping the razor wire on top of the metal gate. And listen to them chanting, Germany, Germany. They're also chanting, open, open. And someone has put up a white T-shirt and written on it, Europe's shame.
Lise Doucette there on the Serbian border with Hungary, and before her, Fergal Keane, with two various accounts there of the European migrant crisis. Well, of course, most European governments have been very reluctant to allow in many of these people, concerned for the political reaction in their own countries and for the immediate financial burden that so many additional bodies may represent to their social services, food, housing, healthcare, schooling and so on. But what in reality are the likely costs of so many immigrants reaching a country? Joining me now here in London is Dr. Tania Kaiser. She's senior lecturer in forced migration studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies. From Washington, I'm joined by Diana Furchgott-Roth. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, and she served as a chief economist at the US Department of Labor in the Bush administration there. From our Oxford studio, we have Alexander Betts, professor in refugee and forced migration studies at Oxford University. And in Warsaw, I'm delighted to welcome the former Polish finance minister, Professor Jacek Rostowski. Professor Rostowski, first of all, as a former deputy prime minister, as well as a finance minister there in Poland, are you shocked, dismayed, pleased, what, by the failure of European governments such as your own to accept many of these people?
Well, I think we have to say very clearly from the start that there's one fundamental difference between refugees and migrants, and that is that refugees under international law have an absolute right to asylum, and states have an absolute obligation to grant asylum to refugees when they are leaving the country where they're threatened, and the state that into which they are coming is the first safe haven state.
Sure, and yet so many countries seem to be refusing them that right of entry to make that claim.
Well, I think we have to distinguish here between those who are coming from Syria, where the first safe countries are certainly Turkey and, so far still safe, Lebanon and Jordan, and those refugees. And I want to say very clearly right at the start that I have no doubt that the vast majority of the refugees leaving Syria are indeed bona fide refugees. There can be no doubt about that. And the refugees who are leaving Libya, who are coming to Malta and Italy, which are EU countries.
So were you still in government there in Poland? Would you be advising the Prime Minister Kopacz to let in more of these people?
The point is that none of the countries that are today more or less under stress, apart from Italy and Malta in the European Union, are countries of first safe haven. And the other problem is that, of course, those refugees, and I stress again that they are genuine refugees, who get to a country of first safe haven, actually want to move on. Once they're no longer under threat, it's natural that they want to go to a country where they think they can make the best life for themselves. And the countries that they want to go to are actually countries like Germany, Sweden, Denmark, maybe the UK. So Poland and the other new member states are rather specific because they're neither countries of first safe haven nor countries of preferred destination, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't show solidarity. But the discussion about the attitude of these countries is rather secondary.
OK, in pure economics terms then, I would ask you, is it possible to distinguish between those different groups? And would you be arguing that allowing refugees in represents an economic boon or a burden?
Migrants generally, historically, have probably been a boon. The question here, of course, is the rate at which they're accepted. And nobody claims that there's an international obligation to accept migrants at an unlimited rate or in unlimited quantities. But since we have an obligation to refugees, the sensible thing would be that when we have a refugee crisis, we substitute migrants who don't have a right to settle with refugees who certainly have a right to have a right to asylum. And here, of course, there are refugees who make a bigger who would make a bigger contribution, and refugees who'd make a smaller contribution.
Professor Alexander Betts in Oxford, what do you think? A boon or a burden economically? What's the record?
I think there's a common perception in public debate of refugees as a burden, and it's not necessarily grounded in evidence so much as media hype and political rhetoric. I think one of the problems is economists have generally not worked on refugee questions, and we lack disaggregated data that actually tells us about what the impact of refugees and asylum seekers are. We've started to try to do some research on that in Oxford to look at the economic lives of refugees and their potential contributions. And we started in a different part of the world, Uganda, because it had a relatively exceptional policy. It allows refugees the right to work and freedom of movement. And we've been able to show there that with socioeconomic rights, refugees can make an enormous contribution. For instance, in Kampala, through a survey, we were able to show that 21% of refugees run businesses that employ others, and of those employees, many are host nationals. In other words, refugees can make jobs for hosts. So the data that we have from other parts of the world says there can be a massive economic contribution. But what we need is more data in Europe, more data that disaggregates and says, well, we know a lot about the economic impact of low-skilled migrants, high-skilled migrants. While the economics of immigration is very developed, we don't know as much in terms of data or theory about the contributions or costs of particular refugee communities. But there's a lot to suggest that with the right policies, people can make a contribution. Refugees represent a cross-section of the population. Their ability to contribute is likely to be shaped by our institutions, our laws, and our policies.
Diana Ferchgott-Roth, there in the US, obviously a population built on immigration. There isn't much argument, is there, that long-term, migrants represent a boon to an economy.
The situation in Europe is a little different because there is really an unlimited number of people who could be migrants for economic reasons, and it's difficult to separate those from the refugees. And that, in essence, is the European problem right now. Who is coming as a refugee? who is coming as a migrant. If they were all refugees, one would expect to find about a 50-50 division between men and women. We find that there about 70% of them are men, 30% are women, suggesting that many are coming for economic reasons.
Or they might be fleeing a particularly hostile war where they're being forced to fight. I mean, Dr. Kaiser, do you see that there is a significant distinction economically between economic migrants and the narrower term of refugees, those fleeing conflict?
I don't really agree with the proposition that because the majority of the people who are coming into the EU at the moment are male, that that makes them more or less likely to be in falling into one category or the other. It's clear, we know very, very clearly from the data which exists that most of the people coming into the EU at the moment, the vast majority, are coming from three absolutely war-torn countries where there is little doubt that remaining is a protection risk, if you like.
Those being Syria?
Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea now is increasingly producing refugees who we're seeing arriving in the EU. So most of these people will go on to get refugee status somewhere. So I think it's clear that if we're talking about the majority of the populations that we're seeing, we are talking about refugees rather than economic migrants. The fact that the populations are skewed in terms of gender, in terms of generation also, with the vast majority being either youngish or middle-aged adults rather than very old or very young, although there's a significant minority of children, as we know, who are part of that population, that makes a difference both to the way that they can be expected to survive the journeys and the likely risks of making those journeys and also to what might happen to them when they arrive.
Yeah, and their economic value, presumably, Professor Rostovsky.
Yes, but I think the thing that we really need to focus on here, I mean, it's a matter of luck whether the refugees are from those groups that will make a large contribution, a larger contribution, or a somewhat smaller one. We certainly know from studies of EU migrants who have a right to settle and work in the UK that they make a very large net contribution, particularly the high-skilled ones, but even the low-skilled ones make a net contribution.
So shouldn't we just be letting them in? I mean, isn't that the point here? With countries like Britain or Poland, shouldn't they just be letting them in large numbers, accepting that these are going to be of value, they are ultimately a net benefit?
Well, they will be a net benefit. There is, of course, the question of how fast they arrive. But the other question, since they're refugees and they have a right to settle, is whether the actual countries that they're applying to are countries of first safe haven. And here we have the problem that has been created by German policy, by Germany saying that it would accept people even if they're coming from a safe country. And that has really upended the expectations of the refugees themselves and created this fundamental problem of how Europe is to share out these refugee groups. If a country where refugees don't want to settle has them allocated to it, how will they be kept in that country? It's slightly different to keep people out, especially if they're migrants rather than refugees. But keeping people in by force is something that certainly Poland would find unacceptable.
Professor Betts, it seems counterintuitive to suggest that all of these desperate people are not going to present an immediate burden to many receiving countries. There's too many of them and their needs are too great in the short term.
I think there's a massive confusion. I mean, we heard from Diana the idea that simply because 70% of men are coming from Syria, it somehow suggests that they're economic migrants. That's not at all the case. There's nothing incompatible about having, on the one hand, a particular legal status as a refugee that entitles you to protection, and on the other hand, exercising choice about where you go to and engaging with markets. And if we look at the Syrian population, it's a population where many people are educated, often middle class. They're coming from a society that until recently had good governance and a good higher education system. And those people have skills, talents, aspirations. And the public needs to be aware that just because you flee a crisis or a conflict doesn't make you any less capable of participating in and contributing to an economy.
You're listening to In the Balance from the BBC with me, Ed Butler. My guests, migration experts, Dr. Tanya Kaiser and Professor Alexander Betts, economist and one-time US government economic advisor, Diana Furchgott-Roth, and the former Polish finance minister, Professor Jacek Rostowski. In a few minutes, we'll be looking at some potential economic answers to this refugee crisis. But first, the thoughts of Colm O'Regan. We've been talking about immigrants and their potential value in the European workplace. It's set a regular commentator, comedian Colm O'Regan in Dublin, thinking about that troublesome concept of modern recruitment, skills, and what exactly the term means.
But what are they all going to work at when they get here? That's one of the refrains you hear in destination countries as refugees approach. Well, I imagine after a long sleep, the first thing they'll do depends on their skills. Skill, it's one of those words I learned early in life, watching the football on Match of the Day, when someone did something outlandish and skillful on the pitch, and hearing that guttural roar of release from the crowd, and the commentator simply stating, "Oh, the skill." As the skillful skill merchant left the well-meaning and hard-working but plodding defender on his behind, I learned that in certain situations, skill cuts through any notions about honest endeavour or doing your best. True skill trumps a thousand words. Which is strange, because nowadays we spend thousands of words trying to describe our skills. My LinkedIn profile claims I have 32 separate skills, or at least those are the ones I have been endorsed for. But I tend to take LinkedIn skills with a grain of salt, especially the ones I've added for myself. Because LinkedIn doesn't validate any skills you add, you can make them up. So I have already accorded myself the skills such as Lord of Justice, Vanquisher of Evil, and Defender of the Righteous. And what's more, I have been endorsed a number of times by my LinkedIn contacts for those very skills. I fret a lot about skills these days. I think about men like my father, the small farmers of the old school who could do everything. They didn't get a man in to fix a thing. There were no consultants. Everything was fixed in-house. The car, the tractor, the fences. These guys had concrete skills. Most of the 32 ones I have on LinkedIn seem so wet and useless. Social media, blogging, content management. Can you imagine any of these qualifying me for one of the spaceships designed to save the best of humanity as the Earth's crust collapses in on itself during the apocalypse? Maybe I'm being too harsh on myself. And I must have some transferable skills. The US government has given me a visa that describes me as an alien with extraordinary ability for my skills as a stand-up comedian and writer. This allows me to work in America on the assumption that I'm not taking away any local jobs. I also feel like the American government is saying, "Listen, buddy, if you can get people to pay, come see you. Best of luck with that," as they stifle a laugh. And finally, one skill I really hope to acquire, taking a sideways economic look at a situation full of human tragedy like this refugee crisis, I want to do it without appearing trite or glib. You'll just have to decide whether I've mastered that or not, but no need to endorse me on LinkedIn.
Oh, go on. Colm O'Regan from Dublin there, a potential US immigrant, it seems. Professor Rostowski, clear this up for me. You've been saying up to now, yes, they are by and large an economic boon, refugees, migrants, when they occur. And yet you are not recommending or saying now openly that you would encourage, let's say, the Polish government to be receiving a large set quota of them.
It's not the case that we're unwilling to accept people, but it's very important to realise, and this point has been made, not only because of the higher incomes that people can earn in Germany, but also because of pre-existing networks, languages they may speak and so on, that the countries of Central Europe are not countries of preferred destination, and it would be quite unacceptable also from a moral point of view to accept people with the obligation of keeping them here by force in some way.
Right, so sure. If they turned up on the door of Poland, just to be clear on that one point, if they turned up on the door of the Polish border and said, "We want to come in," you would say open door as far as these guys are concerned.
No, I didn't say that. The system that exists within Europe and the moral implications of international law are that people should be accepted when they're in actual danger. And the point is certainly today that people are not coming to Poland, and our problem is much more that they are not likely to want to stay than that they're actually coming here. But I wanted to make one other point on the economics of all this. The fact that these people are refugees actually suggests that they're among the most determined and most entrepreneurial of their population of origin. So if you're asking about the economic contribution they can make at a given level of education, at a given level of, as economists call it, human capital, refugees are actually likely to make a bigger contribution than ordinary economic migrants, and I think it's worth remembering that.
Professor Betts, the OECD, the G20, many other countries have been pushing rich countries to reduce inequality within their countries. Isn't the impact of immigration likely to reduce labour costs among poor workers, make life harder, less equal amongst the local population?
I think we know from the economics of immigration in general that high-skilled migration has an almost overwhelmingly positive effect. Low-skilled migration, to some extent, has distributive effects. It benefits many sectors of the economy, such as businesses and employers. It can have an effect on other low-skilled native workers, however. For instance, it can depress wage levels, it can increase housing prices. But there are policies governments can introduce to mitigate that. So, for instance, the minimum wage is a way of ensuring that immigration at a low-skilled level doesn't depress wages below a certain level. And I think it's important to recognise that given those policies are possible, there's nothing to say we can't manage that immigration, so the net economic impact is positive.
Diana Ferchgott-Roth.
The fact that we're probably not looking at this one group of refugees only. Anytime we start to open the borders more, as was the case with Germany, we're going to have more people coming from Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan just pouring in.
You're providing really an incentive. An incentive for people to come. That's what
exactly, yes, that's right. And you played at the beginning of the program a clip from somebody who says he wants his child to study in a German university. Well, presumably he's not proposing to pay the costs of that study in the German university because it's practically free. So there has to be a process of letting people in.
A process? Some what kind process?
Some kind of process where people would go to the consul in the particular country and get a visa, and that particular person would be considered as to skills, or perhaps that individual would have some capital that they could bring with them.
So it would be some kind of auction for skills?
There could be an auction for skills, but for example, in the States, there's different visa categories. There's some for people who have capital who want to start businesses. There's some for people with particular skills, either high skill or low skill in terms of people who want to work on farms. But there has to be an orderly process. Otherwise, it is going to be a continuing problem for the EU because it's not just going to stop at refugees.
Tanya?
The vast majority of the people that we see in the EU at the moment are refugees. So getting involved in discussions about different kinds of visas and different kinds of skills may be relevant for a small minority of this group, but wouldn't apply to the vast majority.
But I think that no matter how we divide up the group now, and I wouldn't necessarily agree that most of them are refugees, it's very difficult to tell. Once the borders are open, there's going to be an unlimited flow of people who want to come from Africa and the Middle East. There's also, when we haven't discussed this in the program, the problems with ISIS, problems with terrorists. We need to make sure that these people do not want to harm the populations where they go, and that we don't unknowingly import terrorist cells into European countries. These are all important questions that argue for some kind of process to be put in place and not just a system of open borders.
Professor Jacek Rostowski, I mean, we've talked about educating people in the economic arguments. Should we be talking more of that? Do you think that people understand in countries such as Poland, or do most people just regard this as a political, cultural threat?
No, I think people are obviously worried about the political and cultural threat. Too worried, because the numbers that are being spoken about are actually very small. So this is naturally a process of acculturation for the host countries. But of course, unacculturated host populations are not going to be populations in which refugees or migrants will feel and will indeed be actually able to find easily good opportunities for for bettering themselves. So it's natural that those are not initially the countries, or not the countries, that they want to go to.
Professor Betts, a final thought. I mean, returning to the economic question, is it realistic to expect the great European public at large to understand the economic claims that you're making and to truly, you know, adjust to a different way of thinking?
I think what we do know is that people's capacity to contribute when they come to our societies is not just a function of who they are and their background, but also of our policies. Our policies shape the opportunities people have or don't have to contribute. I think Tanya made a really central, important point that primarily when we protect refugees, and nearly everybody who's coming to Europe at the moment are clearly refugees, we do so for moral and legal reasons. But in addition, those people are capable of making great contributions. They bring skills, talents, aspirations. They're ordinary people in exceptional circumstances. And some of the suggestions we've heard in this debate have been not at all grounded in evidence. The idea that protecting refugees will produce an inevitable pull factor and a flood of migrants to Europe. There's no evidence to support that. Similarly, the idea that they're inevitably a terrorist threat, no evidence to support that. But we know certain things about the conditions under which refugees can make an economic contribution, and it depends on our policies, not just on who they are.
We better leave it there. My thanks very much to Professor Alexander Betts and to Dr. Tanya Kaiser, both migration experts here in the UK, to the former US government economic advisor, Diana Furchgott-Roth, and the former Polish finance minister, Professor Jacek Rostowski. If you've enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to In the Balance podcast, which you can find at bbcworldservice.com/InTheBalance. And if you want to join in our discussions, you can go to the World Service Facebook page, where you can find all our posts on the topics from the show. Next week, Simon Jack will be presenting the programme from New York. He'll be talking to, amongst others, Sir Richard Branson of the Virgin Group and Paul Polman, boss of Unilever, about what big business has to offer when it comes to tackling the challenges of climate change. A studio audience will be putting their questions there. You can too, via the BBC World Service Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. But for now, from us all here on In the Balance, goodbye.